5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Okay, another outstanding lineup coming your way over the next 2 hours at Yahoo Sports Radio. And we have got a ton of ground to cover in this weekend's edition of the Big East Sports Show. We certainly will be getting some perspective, some insight on the Ray Rice incident. We'll be visiting with Jason Peter in hour number two. But right now, a ton of college football coverage and previews as we head into week three action. And that is where our conversation is going to lead off. Time now to head out to the SEC. We're going to get a preview on Kentucky at Florida. And calling the action for ESPN College Football Game of the Week, that is the great Bill Rozinski. Good evening, Bill. Nice to have you with us on this Friday night.
Alyssa, it's been a long time. Always a pleasure to chat.
Well, we knew that coming into the 2014 season that Florida's head coach, Will Muschamp, he certainly was entering the most critical season of his tenure. And the Gators have come out with their guns blazing. I mean, they scored 65 points against Eastern Michigan. It was a complete shutout. When I saw that score, Bill, I thought this was Billy Donovan's team. What were your takeaways as you have prepared over the past week for this for the Florida Gators in Kentucky?
Well, I think it's right what Will Muschamp wanted from his offense, and his new coordinator, Kurt Roper, has come in to guide this offense, and he, like a lot of coaches now, and led by Gus Malzahn, among others, is a very up-tempo, get as many plays off as you can, and the results, you just mentioned those results, 655 yards against Eastern Michigan. Everybody got in the act. Jeff Driscoll, their starting quarterback, played well. And their backup quarterback, this is how it was for these guys, their backup quarterback, Treyon Harris, was 2-for-2, 148 yards and 2 touchdowns. Wow. Not a bad little evening for the backup quarterback. But that was, again, the opener. Remember, their first game was they had a lot of storms down at Gainesville, so never played the opener. So this was their first game last week. And a good start for them. But I think it was about the offense. Could they get it going? Because Florida's always been a really good defensive team under Muschamp. And they've just not been able to get it going offensively. So at least for the first week, they did.
Well, the new offensive coordinator for Florida, you had just mentioned Kurt Roper. I mean, he continues to harp on tempo, cranking it up, get the offense moving faster, get more plays. But I guess, Bill, you really have to be cognizant. You got to be careful because you don't want to sacrifice speed for execution, right?
No, and I think for him it's about tempo. That's all. Getting his offensive players in a rhythm. For example, they ran 86 plays against Eastern Michigan, which was 20 more plays than they averaged per game a year ago.
Wow.
And the other thing, he looks at when the ball is snapped, and he says the average snap came with 14 seconds on the play clock. He wants that snap when there's 18 seconds on the play clock. So I think I know you want to have execution, but to me it's all about tempo, getting in a rhythm, and getting the defense on its heels. The defense can't substitute as they play this hurry up high tempo offense. And as we saw, the results are pretty good in the first week. We'll see how they do against a little bit better defense than what Kentucky's going to offer this week.
Absolutely. You're listening to the voice of Bill Rozinski from ESPN. He's going to be covering the college football game of the week with Kentucky and Florida. So when you evaluate the Florida Gators, I mean, how comfortable do they look with this up-tempo offense? I guess it all starts with the quarterback, doesn't it?
Yeah, and Driscoll's been around. He's a redshirt junior. And to me, it's all about, you know, who's he giving the ball to? Who's he throwing the ball to? And a bunch of guys got in the act last week. When you put up 655 yards, a lot of people are going to play, and you're going to get your numbers. But this kid, DeMarcus Robinson, had a big game for him. He caught 6 for 123 and a touchdown. Quentin Dunbar is a 50-year senior. He's on this team. Andre Dubose. It seems like I've been calling these names for 10 years, not four or five.
Uh-huh.
So there's a slew of guys on this offense who've been around. And Clay Burton had a nice game for him last week. He could be their answer at tight end. He had seven catches. So I think it's a lot of familiarity with the people he's got offensively that get him in a good rhythm. The running game's pretty good. The only issue I see this week is they've had some issues in the offensive line. The starting left tackle's out. So the right tackle has moved to left. They got a new right tackle in there. And anytime you're making that kind of a shakeup, you wonder how they'll react in an SEC game, which, of course, is what there's going to be, a big SEC game for both these teams tomorrow night.
Okay, so Florida's quarterback in Jeff Driskel, obviously he was the focal point in the offseason, everyone, myself included. Bill, you know, I just wondered how he would recover from last year's injury. And we've highlighted him many times on the show, and I was, you know, very anxious for his return. How good of a quarterback is he, and how does he look in that new tempo offense?
Well, you know, we're just going on one game, and I've called some games with Driskel before, and there have been some issues. There have been some turnover issues. You mentioned injuries. I mean, and this whole team has been snake bit with injuries on both sides of the ball over the last couple of years. It's not just at the quarterback position. But I think, you know, his size-wise, he's 6'4". He's a big kid, 230 pounds. I think he's got a pretty good arm. It's just about execution and making sure he makes the right reads downfield. And I think we'll find out how good he is this year because, again, they've gone through a lot the last couple of years with changes in coordinators and Muschamp coming in as head coach. And it's a big year for Muschamp. I think you mentioned that at the beginning, that if there's any SEC coach under the hot seat, it's Muschamp. And the guy who usually has the brunt of whether a team's going to win or lose is the quarterback. So we'll see what kind of season Driskel has. I think he's good. Is he a great quarterback? We'll find out.
Okay, Bill Rozinski joining us tonight at YSR, the Big E Sports Show. We want to hear from you online. Join us at Twitter, at E Radio Sports. And Bill, you've been on our program many times throughout the years. I know that you've covered the NFL. You're the former play-by-play voice for the Carolina Panthers, for the Atlanta Falcons, and you've covered, obviously, a ton of college football. What are your thoughts on the number of programs that are utilizing the no-huddle offenses? It's really redefining college football.
It is, and for me, it's a nightmare. If you're calling a game on radio,
sure.
It's awful.
I bet.
Because, you make tons of notes about all the players and coaches and little anecdotes here and there, and you don't use a third of them because it's hurry up, line up, run a play. And many times in the no huddle or hurry up, they'll get to the line of scrimmage, but then back off, look to the sideline to see if the coach wants to change the play. But you're already committed to calling the play. You don't know when the ball's going to be snacked. I'm not a big fan of it, purely for broadcast reasons. I understand why they do it. But I also found it interesting this year that there were some coaches who were trying to get some legislation into college football about when they could actually snap the football, you know, giving the defense a time to get set. The theory being, you know, if you're going to run 20 more plays a game, there's 20 more opportunities for players to get hurt. Now, I don't know if you buy into that. I didn't think that was it, but I understand where they're coming from. I did, BYU Texas last week, and we saw BYU run this type of offense. Boise State, my first game in Atlanta this year against Ole Miss, two similar teams running. I mean, you're seeing a lot more of this. Although in recent years, Alyssa, how many of these offenses have won a national championship? And I believe the answer is Auburn.
We're going to step aside for a quick commercial break, and we will be rejoined with Bill Rozinski. Okay, we are so glad you made it a point to join us tonight at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show, having a wonderful conversation with Bill Rozinski from ESPN. He's going to be calling Kentucky, Florida, the college football game of the week. And I guess, you know, when we talk about this no-huddle offense, like it or not, it is here to stay in college football. And I'm sure you would agree that this is now the trend, that so many more of these teams are embracing it, and you're going to see it heading into this direction. Obviously, you were talking about, you made the call last week, weekend with BYU in Texas, and they lit up those Longhorns.
Well, when Charlie Strong said after the game that before the game he knew his team wasn't ready to play, what does that tell you?
Well, and how many times did he say he was embarrassed after the game in postgame?
Yeah, I know.
It was tough.
I know. You know, this kid, this Taysom Hill, the quarterback for BYU, this guy's a player. I would like to see him. In fact, there have been, if you read some of the articles this week, some people throwing out his name in the Heisman watch. Which makes sense. He's played well in the first two games they've played. They've both been on the road. And he's a strong runner. He's got a decent arm. He doesn't scare you throwing the football, but he makes plays, especially with his legs. So it'll be interesting to see in this new age of the college football playoff where BYU as a team fits into this because they're an independent. But, you know, go back to your other, I mean, this is constant here. This is what we're going to see more and more of in college football. And it hasn't quite transformed into the NFL yet, and I don't know if it ever will. Chip Kelly's the perfect example with Philadelphia. But the problem in the National Football League, as opposed to college football, is Chip Kelly has a 53-man roster. He can't dress 80 guys on the road and 100 at home and try to light up a team running curry up all the time and having two or three defensive players in each position that can come in and out of a quickly turning football game. It's a little different in the NFL because you've got a roster of what I think active players 47 on a Sunday, and it's a little different. But I think we're seeing that it's going to creep more and more. You're going to see more teams using hurry up. You see more teams like here in Carolina with Cam Newton. You see a little more of the read option with quarterbacks. Kaepernick doing the same thing. There are some things creeping in from the college game at the NFL level, but I don't know as far as constant hurry up. Whether you will see that in the National Football League on a full-blown basis just because of the wear and tear on an offense that has to play 16 games.
Well, there are certainly pros and cons in the no-huddle offense. You better have a smart quarterback that knows the playbook. But I have to wonder, you know, the offensive line, just the fatigue factor, how much does that change, do you think, the off-season conditioning?
Well, a lot. And, you know, there are now a lot of restrictions on just how the coaches – how much time they can spend with these players in the off season, and not only at the college level, but at the pro level as well. They have cut down considerably in the amount of practice time and, you know, hands-on at both levels of coaches being involved with their players. So lots of times it's up to the players to make sure they're in shape. And, you know, if you're in, for example, this game we've got down here in Gainesville tomorrow night, it'll be interesting to see how Kentucky reacts to this offense in the heat. It's going to be warm. It's going to be in the 90s during the day, and the humidity is going to be high, although it's a night game. It will be interesting to see how Kentucky reacts defensively to this hurry-up offense of Florida's.
Well, let's talk about, since we've already hit on the Gators offensively, how would you size up defensively the Florida Gators? I mean, how does Will Muschamp's defense stack up in the SEC?
Well, you know, they've always been pretty good.
Yeah, you said that. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's been the, you know, the bell cow of this team. I mean, you look at their linemen. They've got Orr's. They're starting front. You've got Bullard's a junior. Orr's a fifth-year senior. Cummings is a senior. Dante Fowler is a junior. Michael Taylor is a fifth-year senior. Ball, another linebacker, is a fifth-year senior. I'll tell you what, there's a lot of experience on this football team. I think they're going to keep Florida. Obviously, they pitched the shutout last week, but I think, and they've been this way. I remember doing Johnny Football's first game at Texas A&M,
okay.
And they were hosting Florida,
Yeah. And
Texas A&M had their way with Florida in the first half. But then somehow, some way, Florida figured out Johnny Football, and Florida ended up winning that football game, and that was the storyline a couple of years ago for that Florida defense. And the same thing happened last year until they had a lot of injuries. This Florida defense would always figure things out by the second half, even if the other team had a bit of an edge in the first half against them. So I just think with the experience on this team, the secondary is not so much. They've got an injury there in the secondary going into this game. You got a couple of sophomores. You got one senior, Gorman, who starts back there. But you look at the front seven of these guys, and they're all well-established players, and they play well. So I would think defensively this team's going to be good all season long.
Well, Florida certainly very impressive defensively. Share a little bit more in terms of Dante Fowler Jr. Understand he's a future first-round pick, and he obviously is a very significant part of Florida's defensive line and has really embraced the role of a defensive leader.
Yeah, and that's what you need, and that's what you would expect of a guy who's going to be playing at the next level pretty soon. But that whole front line is just full of experience, as I mentioned. And even some of the backups at linebacker have already been in the system for a year or two. So, you know what, I think this is an interesting test because Kentucky comes in with a quarterback who's playing with a little confidence, Patrick Toles. They've got a couple of wins. And the big elephant in the room for both these teams is the fact Kentucky's lost 27 in a row to Florida. And anytime you've got that hanging out there, The Florida people don't want to talk about it. Will Muschamp told us that it's, you know, that was last year, that was 10 years ago, that was 20 years ago. And the same thing with Mark Stoops. He doesn't want to talk about the losing streak. Although he did get a little upset with JoJo Kempa's running back this week, who predicted that Kentucky would win this week and end the streak. Anytime a coach hears that from his player, the player is going to hear about it, and JoJo heard about it.
And that is crazy. 27 consecutive games dating back to 1986. Kind of give us an assessment of Mark Stoops. He's in year two. Obviously, his defensive forte, remember him at Arizona, Florida State. Where do you see this program headed?
Well, they only won twice last year. So they've already equaled that total with their two wins. Now, they beat UT Martin, Tennessee Martin, and they beat Ohio last week. And if our listeners didn't know the scores, it was 59-14 in the opener, 20-3 over Ohio last week. And unfortunately, they've had some offensive line issues. They gave up 5 sacks in that game. But again, it's about the quarterback. This Tolles kid is an interesting story because he's born and bred in Kentucky. Player of the year a few years ago as a senior coming out of high school. But when he got there, played about 5 games as a freshman, then hurt his ankle, did not look good in the spring practices the next year, so basically redshirted the season ago. And even when this spring came around, everybody thought Drew Barker, who was an incoming freshman, was going to be the guy. And Tolles beat him out, and so far through 2 games, he's put up some pretty good numbers. So I think what Mark Stoops wants to do here is keep this momentum going. They've got some decent receivers. Braylon Hurd is their leading running back right now, but he's got an ankle issue. And you mentioned their defense. They've got, I think the strength of their defense are their ends. They got a kid named Alvin Dupree, who's a senior, who's a good one. They talk about Jason Hatcher, who plays end, and Desarius Smith. So I think that's the strength. I think Kentucky will come out and try to stop the run. I think Florida's going to try to... Obviously, they'll try to run the ball, but I think the key will be whether Driscoll has success against the secondary and can they put pressure on Driscoll. And obviously, the key, as we've discussed, is can this Kentucky defense hold up to the onslaught of plays that Florida's going to try to run.
Always appreciate you dropping by. It's been way too long, and I promise we'll catch up again real soon. Thank you, Bill.
All right, Alyssa, my pleasure. Anytime.
Absolutely. Stay close. Much more straight ahead at YSR. Okay, we are cruising right along on this Friday night as we continue to guide you through the fastest 2 hours in radio, the Big E Sports Show. And it is time now to preview the 2014 Ryder Cup as actually it's going to be here before you know it. It'll be held September 26th through the 28th, Glen Eagles, Scotland. And we have invited on tonight's show to celebrate the 40th Ryder Cup, Neil Sagabelle. He is the author of his new book. It is titled Draw in the Dunes, the 1969 Ryder Cup and the Finish that Shocked the World. Good evening, Neil. Congratulations on the book. It's wonderful to have you with us at YSR. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you, too.
Well, certainly there is tremendous anticipation for the Ryder Cup, but in your book you share that in 1969 the Ryder Cup teetered on the brink of irrelevancy and perhaps even being discontinued. Why was that?
Well, it had all the great ingredients that it has today. The concept behind it, the international play, at that time it was United States versus Great Britain. What it didn't have in 1969 was very competitive matches. It'd been very one-sided for a number of years. America came in to 1969 having won 14 of 17 Ryder Cups. And so it was a little bit of a yawn on this side of the Atlantic. The British people were very much into their golf. They really wanted their boys to do well. But they were huge underdogs. So it kind of sets up the whole story because that week turned into this very exciting week with a lot of unexpected things happening.
And Neil, you know, the history lesson, that is what you provide, that the U.S. actually dominated the English for the first 42 years of competition since the formation of the event. And I just find, you know, it's so interesting. You look at the 2014 Ryder Cup, there are so many intriguing storylines, and the American golfers, they're certainly, they're the underdog, and many are doubtful that they can win. So times certainly have changed. I mean, Europe, they're riding the top golfer in the world in Rory McIlroy.
Yeah, it is interesting how we've seen that shift, which really started in the 80s and continued to where The team was expanded to be a European team, and beginning in the 80s, one of the stars of this story from 1969 is Tony Jacklin. He became a captain. He was a very good captain. He had some great players, and it started becoming competitive. And now we see the flip to where Europe has won 5 of 6 and 7 of 9, even though they've been close. And I think we're at a point in the Ryder Cup right now where we need an American win. Not just if we're rooting for them, but I think it'd be good for the Ryder Cup for the American boys to rise up and win.
What do you think's been the key for the turnaround for Europe?
Well, I think one huge key is that the players are better. They're so much better. Back in the 60s and even the 70s, you didn't really have players from the other side of the Atlantic playing professional golf too much in America on the PGA Tour. And that's really changed now. We see players like Rory McIlroy and Sergio Garcia, Justin Rose, Ian Poulter, Lee Westwood. We see them every week here in America. They live at least part-time in America. They have all the advantages of playing golf here and playing against the best players in the world. That wasn't true back in the 60s. It was much more separate. You had two different tours, and you had different styles of golf, and you had players that were really different. So a lot has changed to make it more, the parity is there. In fact, as I said, Europe is kind of dominating the Ryder Cup right now.
You're listening to the voice of Neil Sagabelle, and we're going to be talking about his new book, Draw in the Dunes, the 1969 Ryder Cup and the finish that shocked the world. So as I understand, Royal Birkdale was the site of the 69 Ryder Cup, and all experts gave U.S. The resounding favorite to retain the cup. Who was on that roster for the United States?
Well, it was a tremendous roster. Jack Nicklaus played in his first Ryder Cup that year. He was 29 years old. And there were other players, Hall of Fame players. They're Hall of Fame players now, like Lee Trevino, Raymond Floyd were also rookies on that team. Billy Casper, who was one of the veterans. The captain was Sam Snead, who's this great golf legend that a lot of people have heard of. So they were pretty well stocked with players, and I think Captain Snead may have felt like he could take just about any 12 over there and win, because that's kind of the way it had gone. But Great Britain jumped up and surprised them, and it ended up being the closest Ryder Cup matches that had ever been played. So many of the matches came down to the final hole. It was very compelling and exciting. There was some animosity, and it was against that backdrop that we have this amazing ending where Jack Nicklaus makes this great sporting gesture in the final match on the final green.
Yeah, I want to talk about that because as the narrative played out, you mentioned this earlier, the Americans realized it was not going to be a slam dunk. They really had to earn it. And what you said, 17 of the 32 matches over 3 days, they were not decided until the final hole. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah, it was. And I think it probably caught the American players a little bit off guard. They would have matches in the morning and the afternoon. So, and over the 3 days. And it's like every morning, beginning on Thursday, which was when the Ryder Cup opened, America fell behind. And then they had to play well in the afternoon matches to kind of catch up. But they were constantly behind. And it went into the final day, everything was tied. And it came down to the very end. America actually had to rally to get the tie. They had to win. Great Britain only had to win 3.5 points out of 8 possible points in the afternoon session. They would have won the cup. So it was extremely nerve-wracking, exciting. The gallery there was anticipating a possible British victory. People in the gallery, one person actually fainted. It was really thrilling.
Absolutely. Neil Sagabelle is with us tonight at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. We're talking about his brand new book that is out. It is titled Draw in the Dunes, the 1969 Ryder Cup, and the finish that shocked the world. And when you were doing your research for this, what were some of the recollections from whether it was, you know, Jack Nicklaus or Tony Jacklin? Because there was just some electrifying matches between those two.
Well, you know, one of the things that stands out is you watch these players on television, and anybody who's played golf knows how difficult a game it is.
Oh, yeah.
And you watch these great players who are playing professionally, and even back then, and they are so good. And yet, when you talk to them about an event like the Ryder Cup, you realize that inside they are so nervous and so anxious, and they're carrying the hopes of their teammates on their shoulders. And there were some interesting moments between Jack and Tony as they were walking down the last fairway. It's all tied. It's all down to them. Jack Nicklaus said to Tony Jacklin, and they were actually friends at this point in time. He said, "Tony, how do you feel?" And Tony Jacklin said, "I'm petrified." And Jack said, "If it makes you feel any better, I feel the same way." And these are two competitors, you know, matching shots, and it's coming down to them, and they have this exchange. So it's really interesting. The Ryder Cup's a unique event. Players feel a kind of pressure playing for their country and their teammates and their captain that is not like normal week-to-week professional golf. And I think that makes for a really fascinating event.
Okay, Neil Sagabelle is with us tonight at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Google this, look it up online. You got to get a copy. Draw in the Dunes, the 1969 Ryder Cup, and the finish that shocked the world. And certainly, it is an amazing read and one of the greatest acts of sportsmanship, and ends in a tie. Would that have happened today, Neil?
That's a great question. You know, I don't know if it would. You know, I would hope so. And at least one player, Bernard Gallagher, who's still around and still does commentary over there in Great Britain, he said he thinks that would be a perfect ending for a Ryder Cup even today. So I would hope that it could. And I think it's in the spirit of the way the Ryder Cup was started by Samuel Ryder that, you know, there is this element of sportsmanship. You play hard, you try to win, but at the very end there, you know, something like what Jack Nicklaus did, I think elevates the event. So I would hope so, but I don't know if it would.
Well, certainly a glorious moment in golf and sportsmanship, and certainly a significant in golf history. Neil, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight at YSR, the Big E Sports Show. One more plug. Where can all the listeners go and get a copy of this, Neil?
It's out. It's in bookstores. You know, wherever people buy books, they should be able to find it fairly easily. You can buy it online in the usual places like Barnes & Noble and Amazon. So I think it's readily available here in the States and also in the United Kingdom.
Neil, it's a pleasure to have you with us tonight at YSR. We'll talk to you again real soon. Keep teeing it up, okay?
Thanks so much. You too.
Absolutely. Much more straight ahead. Stay close. Okay, we are back with you at Yahoo Sports Radio as we are inside the Quicken Loans studios and a number of exciting matchups in the Big 12 Conference. You've got Tennessee at Oklahoma, the UCLA-Texas matchup, and out of the Big 10 Conference, Minnesota. They're packing their bags. They're heading into Fort Worth to face TCU. And so when we look at the non-conference action, certainly strength of schedule always an important factor as the outcome will impact the perception of these programs. So big tests in the Big 12 Conference. Well, right now we're going to head into Fort Worth. We're going to preview the Frogs and those Golden Gophers. Always a pleasure to have back with us on the program the voice of the Horned Frogs, and that is Brian Estridge. Good evening, Brian.
How are you? We're ready for game day in Fort Worth. It's getting here.
Ready for game day. I'm ready for the train, the sound of the train, right?
Yeah, exactly. We're going to hear the train. You know, if TCU scores, that is. I mean, that's kind of the question coming into this one, because there's so many unknowns for TCU taking on a Minnesota out of the Big Ten. You know, last time they played was 1974. You weren't even born.
Oh, you're being way, way too kind. And no way am I going to give away my age. Now, a number of notables, as you said, you know, going into this game, and I want you to kind of provide the background between these two coaches, with TCU's Gary Patterson and Minnesota's Jerry Kill, because each of them have just a deep, sincere appreciation for each other's program and a friendship that goes way, way back.
if coaches can be best friends, that's what these two guys are, and they are. You know, Gary Patterson had Jerry Kill in his wedding. They've known each other from their days back in small-town Kansas. Jerry Kill was at Pittsburgh State. Gary Patterson was at Pittsburgh State. Their paths have crossed for the last 30 years, essentially. And when you look at their two programs, they're very similar. They're very blue-collar. You know, the theme there at Minnesota is brick by brick for Jerry Kill. That's how he's building his program. And Gary Patterson has done the same thing at TCU. They're going to be tough, hard-nosed football teams that play the right way, but, you know, play with a very physical nature about them, kind of like how these two guys grew up in small-town Kansas. And because of that, in the off-season, they spend a lot of time together. Their wives are real close. They vacation on occasion. So I think it's real neat to see these guys interact. But Gary, quick to point out also, and you've heard him say this before, that you can love a guy during the week, but those 3.5 hours on Saturday, you can learn to hate him pretty fast.
Well, it is interesting too, Brian, a number of common denominators as you were just rattling it all off, but both of these coaches were coached by Jim Wacker, the legendary coach.
Yeah, isn't that neat? And it kind of all comes back to TCU. And, I think that one of the things that's special about what these two guys have done is that they haven't forgotten their history or their past and where they've come from. And they lean on that, and they lean on those core values in building their program. And you can see it with the way their teams play.
And, of course, just to remind all of our listeners, Wacker was the Frogs head coach from 83 to 91 before leaving Fort Worth and taking the reins of becoming the head coach for the Golden Gophers.
Yeah, the tie there obviously works. And I think one of the things about Jim Wacker, both of those places, is he made friends. And how many times in coaching, when a coach has to leave or is fired or takes another job, you know, do the fans sort of, you know, forget about him real fast? And not the case with Jim Wacker. His legacy, both of those two schools at now what is known as Texas State, at Texas Lutheran, always been a guy that everybody remembers fondly. And you could tell he had an impact on his players, and I think very much so like these two guys, like Jerry Kill and like Gary Patterson. You know, Gary likes to joke that players don't always like him when he's their coach, but they usually come back five years later and say, man, I sure did learn a lot. And I think that's kind of the impact that those guys have.
I always love listening to the radio voice of the TCU Horned Frogs. That is Brian Estridge. So, Brian, let's get our listeners up to speed tonight. Of course, the Frogs, they're 1-0. They had a bye last weekend, and they absolutely took care of business against Samford, 48-14, a very impressive win. What were your takeaways from TCU's new offense under their new co-coordinators in Doug Meacham and Sonny Cumbie?
Yeah, I tell you, it was pretty impressive to see him roll off 96 plays and 555 yards of total offense. They averaged about 20.6 seconds in between plays. And the difference was really Trevon Boykin, who started in place of injured Casey Paha last year. But this is kind of his team now. He won the battle in the fall with Matt Jokel, the A&M transfer, and became the starting quarterback. And he's sort of taken off. It's fun to see him blossom in this offense. And we don't talk about football players blossoming very much, but this guy really has. I mean, Trevon has a command of the offense. It sort of fits his mold. It's a fast pace that he really enjoys. And he was very efficient with it last week. And I think that's important for this team. The other takeaway is this. This is not a team that's not going to run the football. They are going to run it. They may not run it with the power running game that Minnesota will roll out on Saturday. But they've got four backs who are very capable, and I think that's going to be a priority because Gary Patterson is going to emphasize possession, you know, possession of the football, and you've got to be able to run the football to do that.
Well, TCU certainly prides itself defensively, but what I hear you saying is there's been a bit of a offensive renaissance that's taking place right there in Fort Worth.
You know, it's interesting. I was talking with Doug Meacham, the offensive coordinator today, the co-offensive coordinator who was at Houston last year, and he said, you know, you don't see head coaches on that defensive side of the ball who play the style that Gary does. You don't see them pair it with this kind of offense very often. And because of that, he's really excited because he thinks it can be a really terrific combo to have a fast, aggressive defense that loves to turn the ball over and pair that with an offense that loves to score points and get plays off. I think it's going to be fun to watch this thing unfold, and the autonomy that Gary has given both Doug Meacham and Sonny Cumbie on the offensive side has been interesting as well.
Okay, you're listening to the voice of Brian Estridge tonight at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big East Sports Show. He is the radio voice for the TCU Horned Frogs, and I know you were rattling off all these different superlatives about Trevon Boykin. What impresses you the most? There's been some great quarterbacks that have been a part of GP system right there in Fort Worth, and of course I'm thinking of Andy Dalton right at the forefront.
Yeah, you can't forget him. I think the thing about Trevon is his athleticism, one. You're gonna notice that, his ability to run and throw. The interesting thing about him this year, Biggie, he's dropped 10 pounds. 10,
wow,
15
oh,
pounds.
Really? Okay.
He cut out fast food, and it's really made him even faster. As fast as he was last year, he's that much quicker now. He's got a quick arm with a strong release, you know, that enables him to get the ball in some really tight spaces. And but the thing about him that impresses me is what I heard Gary Patterson say on Tuesday, is just the level of maturity that he's reached now, that he's gained in this offense and off the field as well. You can tell these guys like playing for him. He has fun out there. He smiles. I love that about players, that smile, that, you know, when it comes to him,
sure,
as easily as it does to Trevon. And I think, therefore, he's poised to have a really big year.
Well, Trevon, as a result, was named the Big 12 Offensive Player of the Week. Talk to me about Matt Jokel, this transfer from Texas A&M. Can he be counted on to help run the show when necessary?
Yeah, I think totally. It was a tough battle, I'm telling you, in the fall. It wasn't a done deal early on. They went toe-to-toe, and I think because of Matt Jokel, Trevon Boykin is better. But Matt brings a different skill set to the table. He's more of a pocket passer. He's a terrific leader as well. When you talk to him, it's as if you're talking to a 30-year-old. He's so mature. And he's handled this situation marvelously. I mean, he has been a terrific team player, and now he becomes kind of an extra coach for Trevon Boykin. Telling him what he sees from the sideline, an extra set of eyes, if you will, but to run this team, that's not going to be an issue.
Well, the backup position is so critical for the Frogs' success. You've got to have that type of stability. And, Brian, you know this well. I mean, look at what happened at Texas, you know, losing David Ash, and they've got Tyrone Swoops filling in. The Big Ten, Braxton Miller. And I think back a year ago to Florida, losing their starting quarterback in Jeff Driscoll.
What is Steve Spurrier's motto about the next man up? I mean, every coach has that. You know, you've got to be ready to go next. And I think at TCU, that was one of the concerns coming in the Big 12, was how would their depth stack up? You know, would there be a next-level guy that was going to be the equivalent of a Big 12 player? Because we knew the frontline guys were going to be. And I think TCU finally, after 3 years, is at that level.
Okay, so Minnesota is a 2-touchdown underdog. I mean, they're physically, they too are beat up. What is the status on their quarterback situation?
Yeah, and that's the latest we're hearing on Mitch Leidner is that he worked out yesterday. They're going to make that decision today or tomorrow.
Okay.
I think we're going to see him. We asked Gary Patterson if he thought there was any difference in the two quarterbacks, and he said no. In that system, in the Jerry Kill system, you don't have to be you don't have to be Peyton Manning. I'm not going to call him a bus driver. I think it's a negative term, but he just wants you to manage the game, possess the football, and as Gary Patterson said, there's really no difference between the two.
Okay, Brian Estridge has been with us tonight at Yahoo Sports Radio, the Big East Sports Show, the radio voice for the TCU Horned Frogs. Always a pleasure and always enjoy listening to you on the radio. Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Much more straight ahead tonight at YSR.